Tehran's government has used deadly force against protesters in the past, but the most recent crackdown there was on a whole different scale.
This immediately rises to the level of crime against humanity.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. How even mourning the dead in Iran can be cause for government repression.
Also in Uganda, the country's leading opposition figure, Bobby Wine, speaks with me from hiding.
I see myself as a candle that is meant to light other candles so that we all shine as a generation.
From Colombia, we'll hear about U.S.-funded counter-narcotics operations now that American funding has been cut off, and reconnecting with your roots through music.
It's my way of channeling that magic and expressing that magic that is in my bloodline.
That's all ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us. We begin today in Iran, where families across the country are searching at hospitals and morgues for the bodies of their loved ones.
Human rights groups say Iranian security forces killed thousands of people during protests earlier this month. But even for those who have been able to collect remains of people who went missing, laying them to rest can bring new pressure from the authorities. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
When I ask Azam Jangravi if she feels ready to talk, this is her response. I'm done crying, she tells me. I have so much rage. I want to tell my story. Her story is of unthinkable loss, of the death of not one, but six of her relatives in the recent protests in Iran. Switching to English, she says over the past week, she's been trying to piece together what happened to them. One by one, in short phone calls with her mom and other family members.
Sometimes my relative call me just for 1 minute or 2 minutes. After 2 minutes, the call cut off.
Iran has been under a communications blackout for 2 weeks. The internet is disconnected. Only landlines work, and only from inside Iran. Jangravi, who lives in Canada, says her six relatives were all men between the ages of 20 and 35. Earlier this month, they went out to protest, like so many others across the country. She tells me about one of them.
From the first days, he was started to go to demonstration, and he was a father of two toddlers.
Another one of her relatives was watching the protests from a rooftop, not even participating, she says.
He was just, you know, looking at the demonstration, and they shot him.
One was shot in the back, another in the leg. As for the others, she doesn't know. The grief is overwhelming, she says, but she tries to keep her routine. She goes to the gym, for example, but in really difficult moments, she slips away.
I go to washroom because I don't want my daughter to see me when I'm crying.
Jangravi herself protested against the mandatory hijab in Iran in 2018. She was arrested and interrogated. She fled the country. Like her, Iranians outside of the country have been getting news of the death of their loved ones with delay. This is a video of a demonstration in London held in support of the Iranian uprising. Pictures of people killed in the protests are shown on an electronic billboard. Suddenly, one woman breaks down after she sees the picture of her brother. This is my brother, she says, sobbing and crumbling to the ground. Families say inside Iran, even grief is being punished. Solmaz lost her brother-in-law in the recent protests. Speaking with BBC Persian, she says the 42-year-old father was shot in the back while helping an injured friend. For 5 days, my family was looking for him, she says. They didn't know if he had died or was taken to a hospital. When they eventually found him, she says, officials demanded money in order to release the body. They also asked them to sign a form that said he was one of the security forces, not a protester. The family refused to sign the form, but they paid the money. This kind of thing is not new, says Hadi Qaemi from the Center for Human Rights in Iran. The Islamic Republic has always demanded so-called bullet money from families whose loved ones they kill.
The number of bodies given is very large, and someone either doesn't show up or cannot afford
We're hearing they're burying them in mass, bodies that are not being claimed or paid. So it is a horrific kind of position for the families to be in the aftermath of this, having to come up with this much money just to reclaim the bodies of their dead ones.
Qaimi says the request is something between $5,000 and $7,000. His organization has been getting reports of intimidation and threats toward grieving families.
In some cases, especially if the person well-known or there's a potential of the funeral attracting large numbers of people and turning to another protest, they're preventing that.
Still, families are holding funerals, despite the threats, as a sign of defiance. At this funeral for 26-year-old Alireza Rahimi, who was shot and killed by the security forces, mourners clap and dance to his favorite music. Hadi Qaimi from the Center for Human Rights in Iran says he's concerned that the government is using the communications blackout to hide evidence of its crimes.
The trickle of information is very small, but everything coming out is pointing to a very rushed mop-up operation.
They're trying to physically erase as many signs of the killings as possible, he says. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafori.
The lack of fresh water worldwide has gotten bad enough that we need a whole new way to think about it. That's according to a United Nations agency now using the term water bankruptcy. The agency released a new analysis this week pointing out that nearly half the global population lives in a state of severe water scarcity for at least 1 month a year, a deficit so persistent that true recovery is now out of reach. Kaveh Madani led the research. He's the director of the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health. When we spoke today, he said to think of the global water supply kind of like a budget.
So when you overuse the water for a long time, you not only exhaust your checking accounts, the surface water, the rivers and reservoirs and all those things that the nature generously renews every year through precipitation, but also your savings account and groundwater is a good example of that. So we look around the world, we see that many systems, many societies have continued to have the insolvency issue, meaning that they're consuming much more than the rate of renewal at the expense of damaging the environment. And that's what we are seeing, declining groundwater levels, land subsidence that comes with it, glaciers melting, and a lot of different symptoms or manifestation of water bankruptcy happening around the world. So at this point, we should be very concerned about the global risk landscape because we are interconnected.
So, you know, we've talked for many, many decades about water scarcity, about water crises, but you're saying this is not just a rebranding of those phenomena that we've known about forever, but trying to illustrate that something different is going on here. It is not just a seasonal drought. It is the fundamental places where the water is coming from drying up so that a place is locked into a cycle of not having enough water.
Absolutely. So what we are seeing is that a lot of problems that used to be anomalies, deviation from normal, shocks to our systems are becoming chronic and permanent. So water deficit is permanent in some systems, even in wet years, even in normal years, the systems cannot catch up. Reservoirs don't get full. Aquifers are still empty. So then the question here, the fundamental question here was, can we refer to them as deviation from something we're used to, a historical condition or a normal? What if the normal itself has gone away and has been wiped out because of our actions? This is why we define bankruptcy as a post-crisis state, as a state of failure, where we have to admit that mitigation is no longer possible for everything.
I want to ask you more about what to do about this in a minute, but first I want to root this on the ground. Give me an example of where this is happening, a place that is already water bankrupt.
So we have been seeing a lot of issues, for example, across the Middle East and North Africa, because they were water poor to begin with, but they also exhausted a lot of resources. Saudi Arabia wanted to become a wheat exporter. As a result, they created a groundwater bankruptcy issue. We have seen Turkey with a lot of sinkholes in recent months. Tehran, in the capital of Iran, was in the news for having a day zero, a day that the reservoirs are empty and the city's taps would be dry. But the report tells us that this is not only the issue of poorer economies or developing world. There are examples, for example, from the Colorado River Basin. We see Lake Mead at its lowest storage level. We saw it recently. Texas is struggling in some locations. And then water bankruptcy is not only about quantity, it's also a quality issue. In many parts of Asia, for example, there is water on paper because there is quantity, but the pollution level is so high that that water is not really usable. And you go to Africa, you see similar problems. You see, go to South America, you see problems. You also go to Alberta, Canada, you see problems. And that's what the report tells us. It's not about how water rich or water poor you are. What matters is how you plan expenditure and how compatible that is with your budget.
Right. Even very wealthy people can go bankrupt. I understand from your research that water bankruptcy doesn't happen all at once. It goes through stages. Can you briefly walk us through those stages, picking one of those examples you just mentioned?
So we start with water stress. So even if you're, let's say, in a very green area, very water-rich area, that doesn't mean that all the water available there is the share of humans, because nature needs to receive some water to be able to support its general functions. So when you take too much water out, then aquifer would start reacting. On surface, you see rivers shrinking, wetlands going dry, and then different parts of ecosystem would be affected. So as you go through this process, what you see is land subsidence, sinkholes, desertification, sand and dust storms, biodiversity loss, because there are species that go extinct. You also see soil salinization, because the soil quality degrades. On top of all of these, you have climate change, which is making water availability more restricted in many places, more limited, and increases the demand of crops for water. That means we need more irrigation. We also need, in many places, we need more energy for cooling, while hydropower is becoming more limited. So the landscape is changing, where when budget is becoming more and more limited and our expenditure keeps increasing.
You know, it strikes me that when we talk about finance, bankruptcy means you get a fresh start. Your debts mostly get erased, but there's no way to simply start over with the water cycle. So how do you propose we recover if we think of our world as being water bankrupt?
So I think, you know, there are similarities and there are distinctions. The good part of it is that just like finance, you have a chance to do better. Bankruptcy, it's not the end of the world. It's an admission to a failure to start a transformative process to save the future. So we think that once we admit to a failure, then we have a chance to mitigate what can be mitigated, save what can be saved, restore what can be restored, but also adapt to a new normal, adapt to a situation that is more restrictive than before, resources that are more limited than before. But it's better to talk about it, because discourse shapes policy choices. Discourse also affects the perceptions of the society about something. We should not imply that a lot of things that we see are just deviations, are shocks. They're going to go away. Unfortunately, that's not the case. But if you're smart, we can enable a better future and pass a better, I would say, planet Earth to the next generation.
Kaba Madani leads the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health.
Ugandan opposition leader Bobby Wine went into hiding after the country's election last week. Today, we spoke with him.
The current state of democracy is dire. Democracy is dying, and unfortunately, like we are told all over the years, that democracy dies in the dark. The democracy of Uganda is dying in the dark with deafening silence.
That conversation is next, right here on The World.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Uganda, 81-year-old Yoweri Museveni claimed victory late last week for a seventh term as president. He first rose to power in 1986. The official results from this recent election put Museveni above 71%. Leading opposition figure Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobby Wine, had 25% of the vote. The musician-turned-politician went into hiding shortly after the tally was announced. He spoke with me earlier today from an undisclosed location.
My current situation is risky. I'm in hiding after escaping from a raid on my home. I was attacked by the military on the orders of the Chief of Defense Forces, Muhoozi Kainerugaba, who also happens to be the son to General Yoweri Museveni, who rigged last week's election. So he promised to kill me, and when I saw other unidentified people jumping over my fence, I did not take it for granted. So I smartly escaped and left my house. As of now, I'm being looked for by the military, but they cannot explain any crime that I committed.
So President Museveni has accused your supporters of seeking to overturn the results of the recent election. The official results have Museveni winning in a landslide with 72% of the vote. Do you accept those results?
We reject those results with all contempt. They are fake. They are fabricated. They don't represent what came from the polling stations. We have evidence, first and foremost, videos, military, the police, and election officials themselves critiquing ballots in favor of General Museveni. The Electoral Commission just decided to ignore the outcome of the election and announce something completely different.
And yet you said you are not going to contest the results. Why not?
Because the courts are not independent. We contested the results 5 years ago, and the courts behaved in a very, very biased manner. Just today, Museveni has appointed the Chief Justice, who is supposed to be the arbiter in this matter. But the courts have made pronouncements and given orders for reforms that were never put in place. So we find the courts not a remedy in any way, but to ask the people of Uganda to invoke their constitutional right, especially Article 29 of the Constitution, to protest against the wrong results and ensure that they are rolled back and Uganda gets real democracy.
Right. So President Museveni controls the courts. That would seem to be your last outlet to appeal. I notice also that the Uganda Human Rights Commission said the technical and procedural challenges observed on polling day did not undermine the overall fairness of the vote. So I'd like to ask you, Bobby Wine, what does all this tell us about the political future for Uganda?
Well, Uganda, like many other countries that have been under the yoke of dictatorship, can and will eventually free itself. We went into this election aware of the predicament that we face, but we also wanted to use the opportunity first to galvanize and to sensitize the people of Uganda, to awaken them, but also to unite them, which we believe that we have largely achieved. Now, the next step is for the people of Uganda to reclaim their constitutional rights, to reclaim their freedom, and to ensure that they restore democracy in Uganda.
So you have urged your supporters to take to the streets to protest peacefully. What are your concerns, though, for their safety?
In a regime that is both corrupt and brutal, people die for not having medicines in hospitals, people die because of bad roads, and people also get shot and killed for peacefully and nonviolently protesting. So in Uganda, we are damned if we don't. We are damned if we do. The way Ugandans are fighting back is the constitutional way, and therefore their legal rights should be protected and not crushed with brute force.
How would you describe the current state of democracy in Uganda, Bobby Wine?
The democracy of Uganda is dying in the dark with deafening silence from the human rights organization, from democracy supporting organizations, and even regional organizations like the East African Community, the international community, and even our regional communities tend to look more at diplomacy rather than democracy. That is unfortunate. The leaders, especially in East Africa, tend to look at the East African community as a president's club.
A president's club.
And not as a community that would help uplift the way of life for their people, uplift the values that we all profess in, democracy, the rule of law, human rights, and all that.
So let's remember the internet in Uganda was shut down during the election last week. What's the current situation with the internet and what was the impact of that?
The internet was switched off 2 days before the election and it remained switched off until 2 days after the election. Unfortunately, the internet has not been fully restored in Uganda. It is glitching because the regime is so scared of people communicating and sharing information.
What do you think peaceful political change will look like in a system where power has been centralized for decades?
I think peaceful political change will involve the moral voices not being quiet, but rising to the occasion, speaking to the powers that be to avoid our bloodshed and to accept and to facilitate a change in their countries. In the case of Uganda, there's no doubt that the wave of change is blowing and it will blow anything that tries to resist it because Uganda is the second youngest country in the world. We have a median age of 19 and we have a widely awakened and informed and politicized population. So it is in the interest of those that rule over our country to do the right thing, or the right thing will do them.
Do you see young people around you who are motivated and want to be part of that change and not just seeing Bobi Wine being part of the change?
Absolutely. I've been encouraging young people all over the country to be the Bobi Wine of their places. I have the following. I am known and recognized, but I also know that we have very many youthful, talented young people, informed, educated, and experienced. And we know that these ones can transform our country if they're given the opportunity. So I see myself as a candle that is meant to light other candles so that we all shine as a generation.
Wow. You are a musician turned politician. Your songs have motivated people. But what is the role of music now in a society where authoritarian rule controls the moral voices that you just spoke about?
The role of music in our generation has gone back to the same role of music through the days of apartheid, through the days of slavery, and through the days of colonialism. Music is no longer for entertainment, but for revolution, for education. Music is to pass information. Music is to motivate and encourage the broken ones. That's why the songs we sing now are only songs of hope and songs of freedom.
Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine speaking with us from an undisclosed location. He released Not My Enemy last year. The song is about corruption. Don't blame the one who exposes the crime. Blame the one who commits the crime. And then in the chorus, Wine sings, I may not be your friend, but I am not your enemy.
I say what I see.
I may not be your friend.
Don't you know the movie?
But I'm not your enemy.
I may
not be your friend.
But I'm not your
enemy.
This is The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Davos, Switzerland today. In a bruising speech, he walked through the many ways Europe could do more to support the Ukrainian cause.
And we have told our European partners multiple times, act now. Act now against those missiles in Belarus. Missiles are never just decoration. But Europe still remains in Greenland mode.
In other words, the Greenland crisis turned European eyes away from Ukraine. As Zelensky tries to recapture attention, Ukraine finds its war with Russia is locked in a bitter winter. For the latest on the situation on the ground, we turn to military analyst Michael Kaufman at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
We've seen a bit of a slowdown over the course of the winter. in combat operations on the ground. And that's to be expected. That's happened in past years. But fighting continues along much of the front in the same areas as before. So if you've been following this war, it's simply been a slower pace since late December, and it's likely to be that way until we get to late February or maybe middle of March.
In other words, when the spring starts.
Yeah, so typically Russian military's sustained offensive intensity from about end of February through December, and I think it's going to pick up quite a bit again. Russian tactics on the ground, which focus on infiltration, are not nearly that effective during the winter. So often their casualties go up and their progress goes down. They're also not able to provide the same level of standoff air support. And that's part of the reason we see typically a degree of slowdown and stabilization from December till February.
And in this slow pace that winter is forced on the two sides, is any significant territory being gained or lost?
So territory is still being gained or lost, but not in large amounts. And to be clear, throughout the course of even the past year, the Russian military had been advancing through fairly incremental gains. Last year, I think, was rather disappointing for them because their casualties went up relative to the amount of territory they took. And on the whole, it went better for Ukraine than expected. I think we're probably going to see a lot of the same this year as well.
Yeah, so it sounds like for the most part, these two armies are bogged down with this really cold winter. What has been the strategy beyond frontline operations?
Yeah, so I think the biggest issue is the respective strike campaigns between Russia and Ukraine. Russia had focused on Ukraine's electricity and gas availability, especially for home heating. This has created huge problems for the civilian population, major disruption in electricity supply and in home heating. This winter is particularly cold and brutal compared to the last two.
We're talking -2 to -4 degrees Fahrenheit.
And I hate to make this obvious point, but how cold the winter is really does matter. And Russia's been trying to create the max amount of disruption. And Ukraine has its own strike campaign against Russian energy infrastructure, trying to suppress the Russian government's ability to generate revenue from exporting energy in order to impact its ability to sustain the war over the course of 2026.
So, Michael, do you have any insight into attitudes in Russia around the war and what the line of public sentiment and its perhaps fatigue is around the war that Putin doesn't dare cross? I mean, is it an economic line? Is there any line?
So I'll be honest, while I don't focus on Russian public sentiment, I'm not sure how much it matters. Certainly, it doesn't seem to matter all that much to Putin. If it did, and if economic hardship for Russians and the consequence of this war were that significant to him, he would not have started in the first place, and we wouldn't be going into the fifth year of the war at this stage. Russia's a personalist authoritarian regime.
So what are your concerns about the next month as we head into the fifth year of this grinding conflict?
You know, my main concern is that it might get even colder still in Ukraine and that the pressure will grow on Ukraine's ability to both sustain the war, combat operations at the front line, and of course, the sustainability of Western support for Ukraine. Europeans at the 11th hour agreed on a Eurobond package to keep funding it, but a lot still depends on the U.S. willingness to militarily sell those goods, those capabilities to Europe for them to provide them to Ukraine. So it remains to be seen how 2026 is going to go. As I'm sure you saw, 2025 was a year filled with disruptions and filled with twists in U.S. policy, tied heavily to U.S. attempts to pressure an end to this war.
That was Michael Kaufman, a military analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He joined me today for an update on Ukraine.
The United States and Colombia have been strong allies for decades, working especially closely to stamp out the illegal drug trade. The U.S. has spent tens of millions of dollars on counter-narcotics operations. And through USAID, Washington has funded programs meant to give Colombians an alternative to working for drug cartels. Reporter Natalie Skoland visited one remote region where foreign aid from the U.S. had been flowing to tourism operations to create jobs.
Kevin Rivadeneira leans over the side of a canoe floating in the Laguna Grande, or Great Lake. He points toward a flock of pink birds in the distance. Hundreds of pink flamingos bob in the salty water. As we get closer, some take flight, gracefully soaring over our heads. This is what thousands of tourists have come to the Flora and Fauna Flamingo Sanctuary for every year. See, Rivadeneira runs a local ecotourism agency called Perlegueneki. It offers tours of the flamingo sanctuary as well as intercultural experiences and fishing expeditions. On this Thursday morning, though, I'm the only visitor at the nature reserve. Up until about a year ago, Perlegueneki received funding from the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. It was part of a $60 million foreign aid package President Donald Trump famously mocked in a presidential speech last March.
Just listen to some of the appalling waste we have already identified. $60 million for indigenous peoples and Afro-Colombian empowerment.
USAID did things like economic empowerment. Why?
Elizabeth Dickinson with the International Crisis Group has no trouble explaining why USAID was spending millions of dollars in Colombia.
Because it keeps people out of the illicit economy. It keeps young people from joining illegal groups. Indigenous communities, for example, are facing an epidemic of recruitment of children into armed and criminal groups. And this is really a symptom of their systematic exclusion from Colombia's economy.
La Guajira is a rural and impoverished part of Colombia, home to sizable indigenous and Afro-Colombian populations. The region has a long history of violence and forced displacement. It remains a stronghold for the National Liberation Army, or ELN, a guerrilla group involved in cocaine trafficking, illegal mining, and attacks on oil infrastructure.
You know, if you're a 14, 15-year-old indigenous girl in Cauca on the Pacific coast, the options that you have to advance going forward, probably your access to education ends after primary or sometimes secondary school. Very little opportunity to enter even technical education. The only job opportunities in these areas are really with the local government. And in order to access those, you often need connections to those politicians.
She says the more the U.S. funds programs that create stability all over Colombia, the fewer drugs we see crossing the border into the U.S. Richard Moreno Rodriguez is a lead coordinator with the Bogota-based National Council for Afro-Colombian Peace, which also received funding from USAID. He says U.S. support was critical to the council's work.
Estos apoyos son importantes y vitales para el tema de paz. En cada territorio donde se haga un proyecto concreto,
Rodriguez says in each place where a project was executed, there was a possibility to lessen the violence, reduce deaths, and prevent displacement. Since the cuts to USAID, some organizations have had to shut down completely. Back at the Flamingo Sanctuary, Kevin Rivadeneira leads me to a local indigenous homestead called a rancheria. He often takes visitors here to learn about their traditions and handicrafts. Yaneris Bonivento, a local leader, demonstrates a traditional dance. Again, I'm the only one in the audience. In a bright, red, flowing dress, she spins in a circle around the dusty, open patio. Bonivento says welcoming tourists to her community is more than an additional source of income.
Para que ellos tengan en cuenta de que todavía existe, de que podemos mostrar.
It's a way to let the outside world know that we exist, she says. That we can show them our culture and not have to hide it. Rivadeneira says his tour agency was promised 3 years of funding through USAID. He has yet to find replacement funds for the U.S. foreign aid money lost. Plans for further expansion and development of his tour agency are largely on hold. He says that affects the fortunes of 40 families in the village, from local tour guides to empanada vendors, hostel owners, and
la del restaurante, la que vende los dulces, y otro servicio al transporte.
Restaurant owners, sweet sellers, local drivers, he says.
Sí, eran muchas cosas y muchas expectativas que nosotros teníamos para los otros 3 años restantes.
There were so many hopes and plans we had, Rivadeneira says. On a grander scale, Dickinson says the souring of U.S.-Colombia relations will have ripple effects.
I think the change has been tectonic, to put it bluntly. Colombia is the United States' strongest security partner in the region, strongest development partner. Should that relationship be affected in the long term, it's not just Colombia that suffers. It's the United States.
In the meantime, Rivadeneira and his fellow residents will rely on fishing in local lakes to make ends meet. just as they always have. For the world, I'm Natalie Skoland in La Guajira, Colombia.
And now, Movement, our series about music and migration. The story in the series is an immersion in Haitian culture. Macleod Hedero speaks with U.S.-based artist Laline Saint-Just about how music connects her to Haiti and her Haitian grandmother.
She was this 6 foot tall, statuesque.
Wow.
Lots of moles on her cheek. I would sleep in her room, and we had a very, very close bond. She had cancer, and I would sometimes put her wig on my head because, you know, she had lost her hair. And then towards the end of her life, I was about probably 5 or 6, she left to go die in Haiti.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And that was my first heartbreak.
I believe in things I cannot see, only feel.
And I grieved deeply for her, and that's how I found my voice through singing, was because I had to do something with this grief. I missed her so much. Mm. We were hanging out every day. And then now she's gone. And so I sang to her. And that's how I started singing.
What was your and your family's relationship to Haiti like when you were growing up?
So my mom went back to Haiti for my grandmother's funeral, and she went back, I believe, one other time. But otherwise, she has not traveled back and forth to Haiti. And growing up, I would be told that the language is not necessary.
Wow.
And going there is dangerous and not necessary. And voodoo is not what God wants. And so it's like, okay, we must assimilate. Don't speak the language. Focus on English. And United States is where you can make things happen. You can't make anything happen in Haiti. The seedlings of my Haitian pride did start to blossom with starting to learn about the Haitian Revolution in middle school on my own.
Mm.
And then so then by my early 20s, I'm like, oh, this is a beautiful culture. And I want to get closer to this place. I want to understand who I am, and I want to understand this country.
In her 20s, Laline moved to Oakland, California, and started taking Haitian dance classes. There, she began learning voodoo music.
We're singing these songs that are about initiation, about going into this next stage. And so we were dressed in white, and I'm learning these songs with other women, and then we're performing it, and I'm just overwhelmed with emotion. I'm like, what is happening to me? We'd come off stage and I'm sobbing, and it feels like something I've never felt before. It feels like a return. It feels like a rebirth. And it sets the stage for my journey of reclamation.
That shows up with crystal clarity in her latest solo project titled Vertuli, named after her grandmother. Early in the album, she calls in her ancestors, naming Dom Vertuli and a lot of people in her lineage.
It's my way of channeling that magic and expressing that magic that is in my bloodline. And the last song is dedicated to Haiti. It's a very, very short, sweet song. I'm singing in Creole, you know, a little imperfectly, just saying, this place is so far from me and yet so close, because when I sing, I feel it and I feel the spirits with me.
Chaque fois chanté, on finit pour moi. Chaque fois chanté, on finit.
So in engaging in this practice of reclamation through sound, through incorporating my heritage in my music, it's a way for me to also heal what has come before me. I can speak to my ancestors through this. I can feel them, and I can facilitate healing for them through me.
That was Laline Saint-Just speaking with Maclet Hedero for our series Movement. For more stories about music and migration, check out Movement wherever you get your podcasts. Ahead on the show, a world traveler and his many encounters getting sought by police across the globe. You're with the world.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek is on a years-long mission to travel on foot from Ethiopia all the way to the southern tip of South America. The Out of Eden Walk is the name of his project. And one thing that's come with the journey, run-ins with local law enforcement. Paul has been picked up enough times by police, self-deputized gangs, and immigration officials that he's even created a map of all of those encounters. When we spoke about this recently, I asked him how many times he has actually been stopped.
120 times.
120. Wow. And how many times have you actually been detained?
I think it's a minority. I think it's like a 16 or 17 maybe times. The bulk of them, about 70 or 80 of those 120, are kind of in what I call investigative stops, where, you know, an officer or a soldier comes up and demands papers, maybe wants to rummage around my backpack. And then about, you know, the balance, say another 20 or so stops, or kind of friendly stops, saying, hey, do you need some water? You know, are you okay? Which also involve, they're kind of quietly checking me out too, mm-hmm. Right?
And you can tell me this with this amount of specificity because you were actually logging all of this on a map online that I was checking out earlier. Why are you keeping such good track of this?
Originally, Carolyn, it was good for two kind of reasons. One was just kind of use these anecdotal stops as maybe one measurement of freedom of movement in different societies. Mm-hmm. And the other was to kind of poke fun at the car-driven world, right? Because in motorized, especially affluent motorized societies, pedestrians are rare and rarer and often suspect. You know, you get approached by police if you're out on foot somewhere in the middle of nowhere, as opposed if you're driving through in a car.
Some of your stops, though, have been a little more targeted, I guess. You've kind of stumbled on sensitive areas in certain places. Looking at your map, there is a particularly dense cluster from when you were walking through Uzbekistan. When were you there, and what was the security situation like?
Yeah, I mean, I can laugh at it now. Again, it's kind of cool for me to look back out on this map, but it was actually very stressful. I walked about 2,000 kilometers across Uzbekistan, and this was back 2016. And at the time, Uzbekistan was governed by an old-style Stalinist dictator, Islam Karimov, who basically, there are billboards I walk by with big eyes on it saying, you know, be aware, be careful, look for strange characters. And sort of I fit those descriptions. And so I was stopped constantly by secret police, by uniformed police. The police would call my walking partner. I had an Uzbek walking partner, and he got so fed up with it, Carolyn, that he basically started hanging up on them. And then they would show up a few hours later in a car, right? So yeah, it was tough. When I finally crossed the border into a neighboring Central Asian country of Kyrgyzstan, I literally got down on the ground and kissed the dust.
Oh, wow.
It was just such a huge relief.
Did you ever feel like you were in serious danger during any of these stops?
You know, this is the thing about my experience even before the walk as a foreign correspondent in some dodgy environments, covering wars and whatnot, revolutions, you know, tense elections, what have you, is that as a journalist, you kind of get a hard shell about police kind of attention, or you have to, you know, or you just can't do the job. But it does wear you down emotionally. It makes you paranoid. It makes you, you know, even after leaving that country, I was looking over my shoulder. Are police still following me in cars, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
You were there for much longer than you were as a foreign correspondent, but you still did leave, whereas people who lived there, of course, did not and lived with that level of surveillance all the time. Did you reflect on what that must be like?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, to begin with, I'm privileged as a foreigner. In the best case scenario, even a police state, I'm sort of a neutral entity, right? I'm an outsider. I'm not involved in politics. I'm walking through on this crazy project. But the communities I was walking through had to live with this day in and day out.
Yeah.
The thing that it's complicated, though, because if you, and I can't speak for Uzbeks, I would even wouldn't even dare, but imagine kind of being born and grown up multi-generationally. And to some degree, it's kind of driven into you from kindergarten that you have to kind of keep an eye on your neighbor. That becomes normalized. People don't realize that. So often, paradoxically, the people who were alerting the secret police on me were the very farmers I was trying to talk to.
Right? Yeah.
After I left, they would call the police.
There were also chunks of your map that I think are highlighted in orange, that where you were monitored continuously. That was in and around Uzbekistan and Saudi Arabia and in China. What does that mean, continuous monitoring? What did that feel like?
Well, you know, one of the kind of the flaws of this fun map, the thing that it misses is two things: high-tech surveillance, and then really low-tech, which is, you know, the police don't actually make contact with you. They don't come up and kind of grab you by the wrist and say, "Hey, stop." But they're two blocks away. They're following you in a car. It's like no license plates, smoked windows. It's got all these antennas coming out, and that's what those orange kind of long lines are. That's continuous 24/7 monitoring.
Was that by people, like you said, in the cars, or was it sometimes, I don't know, drones or something else?
It was both. It was even, you know, even my phone. I can't be 100% certain that my phone is being tapped, but I've just got to make assumptions based on journalists who are there, both indigenous journalists and visiting journalists. And in the case of China, for a period of 10 weeks, I had up to 8 secret police guys, men and women, actually, following me in 2 or 3 vehicles.
Wow.
For you know, hundreds and hundreds of kilometers. And how did I know this was happening? It's pretty easy, because they were checking into the guest house rooms next to me.
Oh, wow.
Every single night. So it was 24/7.
Wow. Yeah, it must be quite draining to live under a microscope like that for such long stretches of time.
Yeah, yeah, it does. It gets mighty lonely, if you will. Yeah.
So, Paul, you are back in the U.S. now. I'm sure you're seeing lots of news from Minneapolis and elsewhere with ICE agents carrying out violent operations and clashing with protesters. I'm curious what your perspective is, given the interactions you've had with law enforcement all over the world in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine. So I leave Eurasia and I take a ship across the Pacific and, you know, land in Alaska, and now I'm making my way south. And when I left Asia, I thought, okay, sort of the most serious practices, the most concerning practices of police, that they're anonymous, right? They cover their faces. They can come to you and basically ask for ID without any compunction. There's no Fourth Amendment. And they can grab you and take you away, was behind me, right? And I know that the ICE agents are focusing on immigrants, but apparently they've taken American citizens as well by accident or whatnot. So it's quite sobering for me. You know, it's a little bit of trepidation. It'll take me about 9 months to walk through the continental U.S. from the Canadian border to the Mexican border, and I'll be keeping this map going. So we might see a whole plethora of new police stops. What is the irony of that? I wasn't expecting that, you know, having been out of the U.S. for 13 years.
Paul, it's always great talking to you about your experiences. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn. Always a pleasure.
That's National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. You can check out his map of police stops online at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston.
and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online at theworld.org and check out more of our original reporting on YouTube. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.